I'm going to start out by saying that if you see me up here weaving back and forth, it's not because I went out and had a quick drink before I got up to speak. I wear a particular shoe called MBT. I don't know if any of you are familiar with it. And it rocks back and forth. And so there are times where if I turn, all of a sudden I may lurch to one side. I'm always careful of making sure that I get up and when I address my faculty and staff, that I do it very carefully so I don't go lurching up to the podium and making them all wonder what I had been drinking up in my office. So just to give you an insight into, where do I, oh, here it is. I'm assuming it's this. Yeah. The whole issue of data management has been a goal of mine for about the last 7 years. I went to Purdue 7 years ago from MIT, and when I got to Purdue, I started talking to all of our department heads. I would go out and say, now, what are your challenges? What are you confronting that you're having trouble meeting? And invariably in the sciences and in engineering and even in business and economics and the social sciences, it was data management. They didn't call it data management. They said, we don't know what to do with all this. They used some expletives, data. And then I met with our CIO, the head of our IT department, or the IT at the university. I said, what's your biggest problem? And he said, everybody coming to us and saying, can you manage our data? And his response was no. And I said, oh, we can help with that. And the response I almost always got was this quizzical look from people saying, we don't understand that. We don't understand how the libraries can help us manage data. And it became very clear to me quickly that librarians have been very, very bad about telling people and letting people know what the principles are of library science. People understand by what we do. They see what we do, but they don't understand the concepts, the principles, the theory behind it. And when I describe this to people, all of a sudden a light goes off among researchers in biology or wherever. And they understand that we're the people they've been looking for. And because I tell them, we look at structure, we look at organization, access, retrieval, dissemination. And the only department that I had issues that really challenged me on this was computer science. I was telling last night at dinner that computer science department was my biggest challenge because they kept thinking we were trying to horn in on their area. And when I would talk about metadata, I would see these computer scientists shaking their heads. And afterwards, they would say, you don't know anything about metadata. Metadata is our domain. And I said, well, that's a little odd, since mainly, basically, what metadata is cataloging. And cataloging has pretty much always been seen as being a prerogative or under the purview of librarians. So it took them a while, about 2 years, but they came around. And one day I realized we had really made an inroad when one of my biggest critics in the computer science department came to me and said, would you do a joint appointment with us in the libraries and computer science? We're developing a knowledge management program, and we realize we can't do it without librarians. And I thought, they've seen the light. Unfortunately, when I went and made the presentation to the department, well, I had to make a presentation to the entire college about what this position would be. I walked into the room, and there was a representative from every one of the departments, physics, chemistry, biology, statistics, math, all of them. And as I was introduced, I noticed the professor from physics started scowling, looking at me. And I thought, wonder why he's so upset. I've never met him. And then I realized this was a Wednesday, and on Monday, we had met with the department, our physics librarian had met with the physics department to cancel all of the print subscriptions for physics. And I thought, he's going to get me. So as I was leaving the room, this professor came running across the room with his hand out to shake my hand. He said, may I shake your hand? And I said, yes, that'll be fine. I'm glad to do that. But can you tell me why? And he said, We never thought about the libraries. The libraries were just this place where they paid the bills. They were nice people, but we just never thought of them. But he said, now that's all we think about is how the librarians can work with us, how they can participate with us in research projects, work with us in teaching, instruction, and information literacy. And he said, are you going to create a library school here? Because we don't have a library school. And I said, no, our librarians are members of the faculty. We're professors of library science. I said, we will bring and interpret library science principles to the needed areas within Purdue. And he said, whatever, we just have to have you. And one other story. As I said, I've been meeting with all the departments. And we had a terrible time trying to set up a meeting with the head of the civil engineering school. And finally, my assistant said, I've got it set up. You're going to meet with her. And I went over to, we always met at lunch, so that I wasn't going to their office and they weren't coming to my office. And nobody usually turns down a free lunch. And so when I sat down with her, she said, Jim, I have no idea why we're meeting. My impression of the libraries are it's full of dusty books with dusty librarians. And I said, oh, you don't know what we can do. By the time she left, she was so excited because her area of research dealt with environmental data for sewers and water systems within cities. And I said, you manage a lot of data, don't you? And she said, oh, yes. I said, you need to talk to our GIS librarian. She and he have now been research partners for the last 4 years. She now says, whatever you need, we will be there to support you. And we're building a new $75 million combined science engineering library. And this engineering school is totally behind us in doing this. So now I'm going to get in here and talk about data. That was kind of a prelude to why I became excited about data. And I have to I have to tell you, I'm a humanist by background. So being working with engineering and science has been a real eye-opener. And I think if I had it to do over again, I would do science engineering, probably engineering. Well, data. We all know that there's been a prolific growth. It's the lifeblood now of science and engineering. And someone asked me, how is it that librarians can now become part of the research in science and engineering that we couldn't have done 20 years ago? And I said, it's the computational aspect. We would not have been going into the labs and helping someone do bench science. I mean, we just wouldn't have done it. But the collaboration with the humanists was very strong, where we would help build collections that they were using. We didn't do the same thing for the scientists. We provided access to their literature, but we didn't participate. There was no way we could participate in their research. Now we do. We have over 100 research projects where librarians are members of the research team within various special research projects. Modeling demands massive amounts of data and, of course, funding agency expectations. But the biggest challenge came when the scientists started telling me what their needs were. I said, oh, we can take care of this. It's not a problem at all. That was my humanist background speaking. I had no idea of how complex data management would be within the science and engineering background. No idea. I didn't realize that each researcher would consider how they share their data differently than how another researcher would, how a certain discipline would consider their data as opposed to another discipline. I didn't realize that there was that kind of variability. So what we really set out to do then is, how can we apply a library science principles, discovery, access, reliability, preservation, to data? And for about 2 years, I was like Jeremiah in the wilderness, telling the campus and the university, we've got to get ready. NSF, NIH are going to make requirements. I was on a panel 5 years ago at NSF, where we made the recommendation to the National Science Foundation to require data management plans. So we made this wonderful sweeping statement, the NSF accepted it, and then when I walked up to the program director, I said, and who's gonna look at these things, and who's gonna even know what a data management plan is? And he said, no one, we don't know what it is. So that was 5 years ago, it's taken 5 years. So I finally went to the provost about a year ago and told him, I said, either we get on this thing and start working on data management planning, or I'm going to shut up. I just won't say anything more, because unless the provost gets behind it and the vice president for research, nothing is going to happen. Then all of a sudden in May, when NSF announced the expected requirement for October, the proverbial all hell broke loose. And all of a sudden we were forming task forces, committees, teams. We get around $500 million from NSF at Purdue. And so all of a sudden it had a huge impact. Last year we had one grant of $125 million. And so to run into the possibility that we were not going to comply with NSF expectations was pretty daunting. And we luckily ended up hiring the former director of the NSF, Arden Bement. He stepped down, retired last June. He was formerly a professor at Purdue. He was head of our nuclear engineering department. And he came back to Purdue to run the Global Research Policy Institute. And he spoke at a conference we held last summer. And he's a miner. He has a mining degree from Colorado. So he likes to think in the ways that he would with mining. And he talked about how the data is the raw ore, and then you consolidate the data. I guess that must be smelting, to concentrate, and then you have the final product, the virgin metal. And he uses those analogies to help him think through and help us think through what it means to conserve a portion of what you actually excavate. Well, the digital object identifier is what I'm really going to focus on today. And as a librarian, I always think of how do we make sure that we tag something that makes sure it's unique and retrievable. And obviously Crossref started doing this initially with many of your company's help in assigning DOIs to journal articles so that there is a unique identifier for that journal article that allows anyone to be able to click on that DOI where it's registered and be able to retrieve that article. But what about the underlying data set? I had a researcher at NSF tell me one day, he said, you know, the best metadata to the underlying data is the published article. More so than any descriptors that you could ever define, that total article is the best metadata for that underlying data. So as many of you are probably already familiar, the portion at the bottom of the screen is a typical citation that includes the DOI for a periodical or scholarly article. And the DOI is more or less a persistent identifier. So what about data? Well, about 4 years ago, I was at a conference in Stockholm, and there was a young man there from Germany, from the National Library, Scientific Library in Hamburg, Hanover. And he was talking about this need to develop a identifier for the data set or the data. And I went up to him afterwards and I said, you know, that's really exciting and we need to think about how we can do this. So over 2 years, more and more institutions became involved. But this young man, Jan Brasse, from the TIB, I won't try to go through it in German, but it's the National Library of Technology. And he and that library and the state and the government of Germany started supporting the registration of data sets using DOIs. They then consulted and asked other institutions around Europe, around the world, would you want to also be a signatory to development of this organization? And obviously the role of it is to establish easier access to scientific research data, increase acceptance of research data as legitimate, citable contributions to scientific record, and that's an important point because now the scientists and engineers, they're looking at the creation of the data sets as a contribution to overall scholarship. But there's no record of who created that data set. No one gets credit, no one's cited for that data. And as people go through promotion and tenure, the impact and use of that data set could be as contributory to the advancement of scholarship as a published research article. So in academe, we're starting to say, we've got to look at what is this contribution that comes from a data set creation. So attribution. We need to make sure that the metadata includes the author or person, corporate, research variables, subject descriptors, disciplinary taxonomy. It's been very amazing to me that in the course of my career as a librarian, we've been using terms that usually don't sound that terribly sexy to most of the people we're talking to, cataloging, C references, subject headings, but boy, we go into these, all of a sudden we're in metadata, crosswalks, taxonomies, it sounds a lot better. And in fact, the librarians, we had to have workshops in order to help people understand the crossover between the terminologies. And so now if you come into the library, we don't have catalogers, we have metadata specialists. We don't have people assigning subject headings. They're assigning and working in taxonomies. We don't have people talking about C and C also references, which were a standard of libraries in the past. We're doing crosswalks between one taxonomy and another. So now here's the same article that has the data set associated with that article. It's one that's for the Pangea project. And here's the article and with the data set attached to it. As I said, this has become an international operation, but it's being controlled in the fact that we don't want a proliferation, because our concern is that if all of a sudden there's a multiplicity of assigners of DOIs, this could get out of hand. And so each country has made a decision and has the ability to decide how many providers of DOIs will be allowed. And so we have one in Australia. Canada has CISTI. United Kingdom has the British Library. The only one that seems to proliferate is Germany, but that's because their national libraries are in various subject areas. In the United States, there are two of us. We decided that with the scale and size of the United States, we needed to have at least two. And so it's the California Digital Library of the University of California and Purdue University Libraries. So the two, and then this past December, we also agreed for OSTI, the Office of Scientific and Technical Information from the Department of Energy. They also are now one of the providers. But the challenge we have is that it's all self-supporting. We have to figure out how to generate the income to be able to cover our expenses. This is the data site structure, the International DOI Foundation. And in the United States, we would have these two centers, Purdue and California Digital Library. And as I said, the two of us now are collaborating very tightly. We have people that go out to California, they send people to Purdue. And we're working on developing the algorithms for automatic loading and deposit and assignment of DOIs. That means that we also then have to come up with a funding model, a business model, since our institutions, out of the goodness of their hearts, are not going to just provide DOIs to the world using our resources. So what we will be doing is setting up a subscription service where institutions, authors, scientists, whoever, but mostly usually institutions, will be signing up, and they will have a subscription service that then anyone in that institution can request a DOI from us, and we will assign it. And when we talk about DOIs, we're also talking about ARCs. We're talking about anything that is a persistent identifier. As I mentioned, one of the important points that the reason why we see DOIs for data sets is so critical is that in the research process, we have to validate the data. 7 years ago, we had a visitor come to Purdue from the National Science Foundation, and it was preparatory to this conference that they ended up holding about data management. And her question to us was, the CIO asked me, he said, Jim, do you want to talk to her? She's coming around just talking about data problems. And I said, yeah, that'd be fine. We were the last people on her agenda. At the end of a long day, we came in and her head was in her hands, kind of staring at the table, and she said, okay, where's your PowerPoint? And we said, no, we're not doing one. We just want to talk. And she looked up and she looked at her list and she said, oh, you're the librarians. And we said, yes. And she said, you have the answer. And I said, yes, we do. What are the questions? But what my question to her was, and she was an engineer from the University of Texas, and I said, but if we do all of this, if we create all these data set relationships and archive these data sets, what is going to be the likelihood that another researcher is going to trust that data set? Because the reason why we're doing a lot of this is because of the funding sources. The funding agencies want to make sure that this data is being mined where it can be useful rather than the funding source paying over and over again for various research projects that could have used other data to be able to answer the question or test their hypotheses. And so I asked her about this, and she said, that's the big question. She said, right now, you would find very, very few researchers who would trust somebody else's data. They have to know all of the variables. They have to know all of the conditions. And I said, well, is there any possibility that researchers will modify how they do their research so that they can say, well, here's a data set. There are 18 variables that work. Two variables that I think are necessary aren't here, but I don't know if they're going to be contaminating or not, so that I could go ahead and test my hypothesis against this data set to see if it might work, to give me some clues. And she said, possibly. She said, but people are very, very particular about where their data comes from and how it's been archived and how it's been maintained. So she said, it's going to take a change in the way the scientists, the engineers do their research. And I think it could happen. And then looking at what the impact factor is. We're already looking at the H index for data set impact. And there's already some evidence that there is an impact of a data set in publishing. Can STM publishers assist in the registration of data sets? Yes. We know that many of you are requiring that data sets be deposited at some repository. And every university is struggling right now to try to figure out how to meet the requirement. At Purdue, we're creating a repository, and many other universities are creating repositories. But it is a challenge for us to know, ultimately, what our responsibility is to both the publisher, to the author, to the funding agency, and ultimately to the university because of the cost implications. So I'll stop here, and we do have a couple minutes if you have some questions.
Is it on now? Well, one, two. In your special position as taking a question possibly before you leave, we'll just take maybe two questions.
Yeah. Well, there's one right there.
Let's go with Mark. He's got the microphone already.
I have a question about your metadata for data site. I assume that one of the metadata elements is the funding agency?
I can't answer that question.
That's a mistake we made in Crossref by not putting that in there for very first beginning.
Yeah.
The agencies really want that.
Yeah, and that's a good point. I'll make sure. One of my associate deans is really involved in all of this, and so I'll make sure I go back and ask him about that. Good.
Yeah, just the one more, whoever is privileged enough to be holding the microphone.
Lyndon Holmes, Aries Systems. Why wouldn't the publisher assign and deposit DOIs for a data set as part of the publication process? What's the added value of data site in terms of being a registration agent for the DOI?
Well, it's one that's very close to the heart of librarians. We want to keep the data in the public domain, and we're concerned that if the data were deposited within a publisher's domain, ultimately that data could become a commodity and therefore could be turned in and being sold again to us. And so we're very concerned that the data be kept in the public domain.
Hold on. Can you hold on 1 second? I know I'm conscious that we've only got a couple of minutes. I don't want to run behind with the other speakers, and rather get into a dialogue, maybe we'll have time for another question later. And I'm going to break my own rule because I think I've got 30 seconds left. And Dan Colt from the sister society, the American Physical Society, is staring at me. So can someone pass the microphone to Dan? And that will be the last question, I promise.
Thanks, Terry. I appreciate that. My question concerns the assignment of the DOI as well. Not so much about maintaining it within the publisher realm, but has there been any thought of doing sub-DOIs to connect the data sets with the actual published document, the article?
Yes.
Because to me, that means the DOI contains all the pertinent information that you'd like.
Yes. No, there is the link back both ways. That's been just discussed recently. I do know that. Yeah.
That's great. Thank you very much,
Thank
Stuart.
You.